community events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, and welcome to the February edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch, one of the co-hosts of the program, and joining me today from Washington, D.C. is Rosemary E. Reed Miller, who is the author of Threads of Time, The Fabric of History, Profiles of African-American Dressmakers and Designers, 1850 to the Present. Good morning, and welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, I do want to mention to our listeners that we were listening to, I believe it's called Arctic Rhythms, the music that came on before this, and it was by DJ Spooky, who is also Paul Miller and your son. And just listening to him talk about what he was doing and why, it was fascinating. It totally eradicated my image of people whose names are, their alter egos are DJ anything. I was like, wow, this is an absolutely, sounds like he's just a brilliant young man with a sort of a universal aspect. So thank you for sending us to him. He's also an author, and thank you for sharing his music with us. We will also close out with that.
Well, thank you for having both of us. It's a pleasure, really a pleasure.
Okay, now tell me about this book. What was fascinating to me about the book is that, one, these people who were talented, creative, did fabulous work, some not well-known, but others very prominent in their field, but they had such full lives. I mean, in addition to their lives as designers and dressmakers, they were involved in the community. So tell me a little bit about, you know, why you chose to do this, what was important to you.
Well, I used to have a clothing store downtown in DuPont Circle here in Washington, D.C. It was called Toast and Strawberries, and we sold everything but toast and strawberries. And we did a lot of fashion. People asked us to do a lot of fashion shows, which we certainly enjoyed doing and whatever. And then one woman said to me, can you do something for Black History Month? Could you do something for on Black designers? And I said, oh, my goodness, of course. But then I realized, with all the information I knew and reading, I only knew of contemporary Afro-American designers. And I went over to Howard University for help, and they gave me a whole, about seven of them. And that started me on a whole cycle of wanting to know about women from the past. All of them, you're right, had very amazing design histories. And Eliza Gardner, when you're talking about community activists in Boston, her family sales for clipper ships, and they did very well. They were free from New York City and moved to Boston, and she did well enough to do extra help in the Boston community. She helped women get jobs out of just maid work, and she donated about $600-some to her church, and she worked on missionary work in the South. This is in the 1850s, 60s. We have to remember that would be an area for, you know, missionaries to go down to convert slaves to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then also they funded missionaries to go to Africa. So she was really a fantastic person. Elizabeth Keckley, who did the designs for Mary Lincoln, I don't know if you saw the movie Lincoln, but she was there next to Mary Lincoln, and she helped raise money for the contraband of these freed slaves, and did all kinds of community work, because when they reached usually a very decent income level, and so people did ask for help and expected help from them, and they rose to that occasion.
And see, that fascinated me, because that's a story that hasn't been told. Generally, when we think of philanthropy, we are thinking of white philanthropists who were assisting black people. But for instance, for Elizabeth Gardner, and I want to mention to our readers, this woman was born in 1831. And we don't generally, the story of people who were freed and who actually were financially secure, who in many ways were flourishing, that's not a story that we hear. And the fact that while her family, their home was a station on the Underground Railroad, so they were absolutely politically involved, and yet, you know, the family was comfortably off enough that they could send her to school. You know, she was brilliant, and they could support that. We simply don't, you know, I have not heard about that before, so I just was happy to see the story being enhanced, additional information of what life was like at that time, and certainly what life was like for a talented black woman at that time. That was fascinating. Okay, so bring us up a little bit farther in history. We're in the early 1800s. And
I miss Liza Gardner's Boston. Margaret Hagen is in Washington, D.C., and she did well enough that she actually opened a resort in Pennsylvania. She was, God, some of the stories are so fantastic, and a lot of them are connected to American history. Liza Gardner was related to Judge Taney, who was on the Supreme Court, and he was the one who ruled against, the vote that that went against the freeing of slaves who were, there's so much stuff I'm trying to do at the same time.
There's so much information in this book. Let me see. Are you talking about Charles Sumner, the senator who...
This is Taney.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Who was on the Supreme Court.
Okay,
Dred Scott. He ruled against Dred Scott.
Oh, the Dred Scott. Okay, he issued the Dred Scott decision. Okay, yes.
Against it. But she was related to him, and she was bought by a man from Madagascar who she was supposedly beautiful, and he married, and his family is still, there's descendants all throughout Maryland.
Okay, living history. I'm curious, tell me how, or tell us how, Elizabeth Keckley got to be one of the seamstresses for Mary Lincoln, because apparently she had a number of women who worked for her.
Not really. As far as I know, it's basically Keckley. Keckley is from Virginia. Her family, she was a slave. Her mother was a slave. But she sewed very well, and she is interesting, even though the people weren't that pleasant. They were educated. I think we forget how few people in the early days in the 1800s were educated. They moved to St. Louis, which is, again, a town in the 1800s that had a large German population and was a high-level education. She worked for this family doing the women's dresses, and then she did so well that the family hired her out to do designs for people in the community. She did so well. She wanted to be free, and she was trying to buy her way out, and the master... She was supporting 17 people in this household. They weren't really that interested in letting her go. He actually said to her, well, why don't you just go across the river free to Missouri? And she said, no, I want to have a business, and I don't want to, you know, to have a slave, slave catchers come after me, and then it would spoil my whole business. So she finally convinced him to sell her son and for $1,800. This was in 1850-something. That doesn't sound like a whole lot, but that amount would be about $10,000
yes.
now. She could read. She sold dresses from that were costing in those days between $7,500
and $200. Whoa, yes.
And she had a son. So she moved first to Baltimore. It didn't do as well. She was given letters of introduction by her wealthy friends in St. Louis, but hit Washington. And Lincoln actually knew of her. She had a very good reputation. And so she, even though she did query other women to be designers for her, basically Keckley had a clear in because she had a reputation of designing for the primary people in Robert E. Lee, people in the city who were super, super top social and income. So Mary Lincoln was very happy to have her.
Great.
And then later, Keckley wrote a book about, she was trying to help explain Mary Lincoln, who was probably compulsive. One time she went and bought like 500 gloves, and she would just bought clothes and all the time, and she'd be juggling her bills, and President Lincoln would say, well, who is this man asking for money? And she said, oh, I really paid him, or he really isn't owed money. But of course the man was. These are merchants who were trying to collect from her and of course collect from him. But she sort of ran herself crazy and whatever. But then afterwards, after Lincoln died, she again had a lot of debt. She even tried to sell her clothes in New York City, and it just didn't work. And Keckley was there to help. But Mary Lincoln was very difficult to, direct. And then Keckley wrote a book about her life with Mary Lincoln for the 4 years in the White House and then afterwards. And her book is used for scholars who want to know about the personal lives of Lincoln. There's a million books written about Lincoln, but she actually had a view of, you know, entree to the family. And her views were, people would use her words and refer to her in her book. It was called 30 Years as a Slave.
Was there any backlash against her sharing this information about the Lincolns?
Oh, yes. Again, she was very, very pleasant and naive. She thought she was helping Mary Lincoln.
Oh,
but when she wrote this book, she did good and warts and all.
Ooh.
And people felt like, oh, how could I? It's like having the maid write about you, because the maid is privy to all kinds of information about a family, if you understand it, you know. And they were flabbergasted and really punitive. Black people felt she had sort of, this was after Lincoln died, that she had bared secrets, and white people were just scandalized. And Elizabeth Keckley thought she would get some income to help help Mrs. Lincoln, but it just didn't work. And she was a top society designer, wrote the book, and nobody went to her. She just literally had to get a job out of the city. She had to leave.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because, I mean, when you think about it, people who are in service, they know every detail of the private lives of people. And the assumption is that, you know, they will not share, who would they know? So I'm thinking that what she did was not only scandalous in terms of the larger community, any community hearing about it, but may have jeopardized positions of other people who were working in positions similar to her, that suddenly the families would look at them and think, oh, wait a minute, what have we said? So, yeah, she was naive. Of course, nowadays there are non-disclosure agreements signed before any of this, so hopefully that wouldn't be a problem.
Nobody expected her to be as... Well, she's also very frank. She could have been more selective, maybe, but she literally just told it as it was. Mary Lincoln was so absolutely, again, probably had mental problems, and her son actually put her in a sanitarium.
Yes.
So she was especially a special case of extreme. But again, if she hadn't written that book, scholars would not have the information about Lincoln's that she was able to give us.
Yes. Want to give us another favorite from the 1800s, or do we want to jump up and get a little closer to modern times?
I think I'd rather move, because Anne Lois, who is a
yes.
designer also for high society, has a fantastic story. She is from Alabama. Her mother actually did work for the governor's wife, so that's a very high status job to get a work for the governor of Alabama's wife. She actually did a wedding, but she really wasn't happy living in Alabama. She was free at that point, but this is early 1900s. She moved from Florida, did very well, again, selling and designing for the top society people in the Tampa area. And she wanted to be a designer, a real full-fledged French designer. She saved up $19,000. Now that, again, that would be about over 20 times that, about 50-some thousand plus,
okay.
And moved to New York. She took a course from a French designer who didn't believe she had money. She had to show him her bank booklet, and he still put her in a separate room. Heard that story before.
Yes.
But he did give her techniques that were even refined her level, which was she was super top anyway. And she opened her a store on Lexington Avenue, a small, store, and designed for, again, top society in New York City. She said she didn't want to do for celebrities. She just wanted to do for debutantes, bridal, and whatever. And she did work for Jackie Kennedy and her sister when they were in high school. Well, she was really doing work for her mother, but did work for them. And when the wedding came up, even though Jackie Kennedy wanted to have a very severe kind of plain dress, like a Vera Wang, if you can get a visualization of that, Joe Kennedy and her mother wanted to have a more traditional dress, and Anne Lowe got the contract for the 11 people in the bridal salon, bridal party. The side story is that a couple days before the wedding, this is 1953, some water pipes burst in Anne's store, and about 7 or 8 dresses were damaged, and Anne had to do this. Anne was hoping to have a profit, etc., and didn't. She had to do the dresses totally over, and she could not charge the bride. And that wedding, I don't know if you have a visualization of it, but we thought in our studies, I'm from Philadelphia, and Grace Kelly married the prince from Monaco. Mm-hmm. That was a very, very big thing. But Joe Kennedy wanted one of his sons to become president, and Jack was 39 years old, and he was still running the streets. And Jackie was 19, and they just sort of kind of put a, lasso around John and said, "You've got to stop and get married." And they, and even though Jackie was engaged to somebody else, a stockbroker, she knew that the Kennedy money was much, much heavier, and was, very much open to get married to John Kennedy. And so Joe Kennedy wanted to have anybody and everybody in America, again, his son was running for president, or was going to run for president, to know about the wedding. So every photographer, just in massive publicity. However, which is, the sad part, is that nobody, I looked at, they actually had stories before the wedding. Very seldom do you have a story the week before a wedding. The Boston Globe, New York Times, nobody had who the designer was. That wouldn't be hard to figure out or know. Nina Hyde here in Washington, D.C., who wrote for the Washington Post, started her whole article saying, The dress was done by Negro designer Ann Lowe. Jackie was asked who did the design, and she said a colored dressmaker. Ann was furious, but that any reporter who was worth anything could have asked what is the name of the person. And so for years, people just kind of passed over the Washington Post, and it was kind of, the dress was lauded, but who did the dress was another thing. The dress won all kinds of awards and whatever. Parade magazine said it was the most beautiful wedding dress ever, but again, no name.
Now, was Jacqueline Kennedy, how did she feel about this? I mean, you know, she had a certain style, which anybody who's familiar with her, it is very simple, but did she say okay? Was she resistant to this or what? I mean, the fact that she did not give the woman's name says to me there might have been some lingering resentment or something.
Maybe, but she's 19, and she's not paying for the wedding. It's her mother and Joe Kennedy, and that's who they wanted.
Okay. I'm just thinking nowadays, when every detail of everything is covered, there would have been a feature story on whoever was the designer and dressmaker. So, yeah, of course, that tells us something about the times.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Because, again, I remember I said they did stories before the wedding. And then every reporter, every photographer who could walk was at the wedding. They had over 5,000 people in Rhode Island, this is where it was. And the incredible, we said it was the most photographed wedding dress probably in American history.
But still, because of her workmanship, her craftsmanship, she still had lots of customers and did well in spite of that little bump.
That was a major bump because, again, it's not supposed to be.
Yes, major bump.
Oh, we are
her
joined.
Name is not attached to it. That's very sad.
Yeah.
Okay, we've been joined by Emma Jackson Ford, co-host and producer of the program. So, Emma.
Okay, hello.
Good morning.
Morning. For us, it's 2 o'clock.
Yeah, you're in Washington, D.C., and hopefully has the snow gone back home? Are you still?
Basically,
we read about the piles and piles of snow.
The streets are clear.
Good.
Streets are clear.
Very good.
Before I came, did you talk about Rosa Parks?
Rosa Parks was in the 1950s, and what she was doing was alterations at a department store, the main department store, and she was tired that evening. But she had actually they were working on. Integrating the bus system, but this came up. That one night that she was really tired and decided not to give up her seat. It just went forward faster than they thought. But they had been working on that.
I'm the librarian for Rosa Parks Elementary, and today is her birthday, so I've been talking about her all morning. But I wondered if she ever had a real career as a seamstress. I know she moved from Alabama, but
to Detroit.
I know that she moved, but did she ever have a career other than altering clothing at a department store?
She worked for Conyers after a while, mm-hmm. Congressman Conyers in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
She did alterations, as you know. And then she worked for Conyers. He gave her a job, and he felt somebody should be supportive of a woman who helped in American history.
But she never did anything more with design or clothing?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, I'm going to ask her something on one of my favorites, Pauline Brooks, and that's because she was in Baltimore, and I'm from Baltimore, so.
Oh, yeah, I forgot, yeah.
Yeah, so now, you know, she, 1950 to 1996, so she's, you know, 20th century. Can you tell us a little bit about her and what her primary accomplishment was?
Well, one, she owned a store. She started out as a small store, I forget what street, and did very well. I don't think there was, there could have been another black-owned store, I just don't know. I know my research doesn't tell me that, but I know her and her daughter. But she did well. She was very organized. She had worked for a clothing store, that was it. She had worked for a clothing store, so she had a real, it wasn't something that she just popped up and did. Mm-hmm. She actually did the buying, and she went to New York for the store and whatever. And so she had a very, very ambitious idea. And then she went over to Mondawmin Mall.
Mondawmin, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Very, very fantastic. Everybody was, like, thrilled that she, you know, would go there. It was a new mall, and mm-hmm. it was all, well, you know, modern and whatever. And she did very, very well there up until about 1970s, 80s. About 80s. And I think she closed, I'm not sure the date in the 90s when she closed. Her daughters continued to move downtown and continued the store for a while. And it didn't work. It was just very nice.
When it was open, it was very nice. The junior high school that I went to was within walking distance of Mondawmin. And so, you know, when we be walking home to save money to buy somebody's birthday, Mother's Day, or whatever's gift, we would stop in Mondawmin, as teenagers still do. And hers was one of the stores that you would go into and say, okay, I'm going to save money and buy something nice for my mother. From here, it was just a very nicely appointed store, and the people were gracious, and you know, just the kind of store that made you proud. Even though I have to admit, I don't think at the time that I gave much thought to black ownership or not. It was a lovely store in a great new mall. So it's just nice to have her included in this book.
Yes, well, I felt she was very. She did fashion shows up and down the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, she took owning a store to a nice level. And businesses in the black community really struggle, you know, certainly having black clientele and mixed clientele and whatever, but it's a real struggle. When you were a younger, a lot of the girls would get their prom dresses done there. Sororities would get their debutante dresses done there. People did a good deal of support and whatever, but
yes.
Again, it's so hard when the total community opens up, that is, the department stores that were very snotty to blacks or didn't allow them at all, or they couldn't try on. Once
yes.
they opened up, it was very, very difficult to continue, you know, at the same level.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah, and continues to be. I do want to say for our listeners, yes, there are lovely pictures. You don't have to imagine or try to recall Jackie Kennedy in the wedding gown or anything. You have assembled a lovely collection of photographs that bring many good memories to mind for some of us, but also let us know why these people were included in this book.
Well, I tried to get I wanted to get a geographic spread. That was one, you know, real thought, too. I was trying to get people who were in different areas. Really, quite frankly, my mother taught art in Philadelphia, and I was just amazed. If I didn't know of people, and I felt this is very much a salute to our aunts, our mothers, our great-grandmothers, and whatever, who almost everybody sewed, white or black. You learned,
yes.
You took, later they took home ec courses, but basically in the home, most people knew how, women, I guess I'm into too, but women would know how to sew. And they would do all kinds of stuff, you know, milliners and whatever, but in the community, they someone who did, that was, okay, that was one of the first kind of businesses I was interested in because I owned a store. But I was interested in women in business. One of the few stores that is a woman-owned store when you go to almost any kind of community, small town, whatever, would be a milliner's shop, you know?
Yes.
And the other one would be a woman who did some cooking, and then the other would be a woman who was a dressmaker. They were one of the paths for women for business ownership.
We have just 2 minutes to go, but I want you to say something about Sally Stone Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
No, she was, yes. Nellie Stone. I'm looking at Ian calling it S.
And say what? I couldn't hear that.
Would you say a little something about Nellie Stone Johnson?
Yes. She's from Minneapolis, and she took again dressmaking to a very good, very systematic level, which is what I was looking for. She got union contracts to do alterations and things like that.
Yes, I love it that she was a union activist and a designer.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I felt this. I was trying to. It was. I really wanted to do. Nellie Stone, I thought, was really important. Annie Malone in St. Louis was incredible because she actually had hired Madam C.J. Walker, and she did $13 million a year. That's incredible.
Oh, gosh, yes.
But Nellie Stone, there's actually a statue built to salute her. But I liked it because she was actually in business, if that can make sense to you.
You know something? We're going to have to bring you back and hear about more of these fabulous women, because we have to close out so that the next show can start.
Yes.
But I do want to say, Rosemary Reed Miller, thank you so much for joining us. And we encourage our listeners to get a copy of Threads of Time, The Fabric of History, third edition. This is just a great historical document. And for
thank
Black,
you for having us.
Thank you. For Black Book Talk. This is February. We'll see you again in March. Good reading to you. This is Patricia Welch, the library lady, and
Emma Jackson Fort, saying goodbye until next month.
All righty.